Another round of quantitative easing from the Federal Reserve. Will the third time be the charm?
And Amazon might be about to start charging you sales tax. Sorry. Hello, I'm Jeff Horwich.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. This is the Marketplace Midday Update for Friday, September 14th. Yesterday, the Federal Reserve unveiled its latest round of economic stimulus. This time, it's buying up mortgage-backed securities.
We'll also talk about a plan from Japan we're hearing about this morning to phase out nuclear power. And we'll look at what happened to the surprising amount of money raked in by the Occupy Wall Street movement. Bunch more stuff as well coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune in to Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
Markets are up today following the announcement of another round of quantitative easing. The Fed will spend $40 billion a month buying mortgage-backed securities to keep interest rates down and inject liquidity into the U.S. economy. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 1.5% the afternoon after the announcement, and it's up a bit today as well. You might reasonably take this as evidence that the earlier rounds of quantitative easing didn't work. Well, earlier today, reporter David Gura spoke with Ellen Zettner, who is a senior economist at Nomura Securities. She says, in fact, it's quite the opposite, as shown by yesterday's favorable markets reaction.
It just underscored that no matter how much markets think the Fed is done and can't possibly deliver more, they still are able to dig into their toolbox, mix it up, shake it and bake it, and deliver more than the markets expected.
The news sent Asian and European markets up today, too. In Hong Kong, shares closed up almost 3%. China, after all, relies on the U.S. for about a fifth of its exports. In Europe, where good news can be a little hard to come by these days, the continent-wide Stoxx 600 index is up more than 1% at this hour. James Knightley is a senior international economist with ING, and he's with us from London. Hello.
Hello.
European markets seem to be doing what they usually do after a Fed action like this, which is to say they're up pretty much as ours were yesterday. To what extent does this offer real relief from the pressures in Europe?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of points here. September was always feared as a potential very dangerous month for the whole Eurozone economy. In the end, the ECB continues to offer support and is looking to step up its bond buying program. And also the Dutch elections, we've actually got a pro-EU government in. And now, of course, we've got this extra stimulus from the Federal Reserve. So it's very much positive outcomes all around.
But how does this work? How does quantitative easing here in the US actually relieve pressure on the European economy?
The idea is that the support for the U.S. economy helps the U.S. economy in general, and therefore they suck in more imports from around the world, and that helps to boost Eurozone economic activity as well. But also it helps support companies, share prices rise, and if firms become more confident, they're more likely to invest and hire workers as well.
James, is there any downside for other countries in Europe or elsewhere when we undertake an expansionary monetary policy like this?
Well, if you remember sort of last year, we've been hearing talk about currency wars, whereby a lot of countries have been very concerned about the Federal Reserve's actions. If the dollar weakens, it puts up the value of the currencies elsewhere. And in that environment, if the euro is continuing to appreciate, then that is a big headwind for growth, because if you're trying to export, it's much harder when your currency is strengthening. So that is a clear concern for Eurozone authorities and could actually prompt them to offer more stimulus as well to try and offset that drag.
ING Senior International Economist James Knightley. Thanks.
Thank you.
We've had a lot of economic data headed our way this morning, Jeff. Among them, consumer prices. They're up in August by the most in 3 years. Have you noticed prices rising at all in Minnesota?
Well, I have been back in Minnesota for all of like a week and a half now, but I'm already hearing people complain about the gas prices going up.
Well, in fact, most of the 0.6% jump that consumer prices saw last month was because of gas. But it's still not the kind of inflation that is worrying most economists.
Also out this morning, U.S. retail sales rose in August for the second straight month. Gas prices had something to do with that as well. They go
cropping up everywhere.
Naturally spend more on gas. But interestingly, people were also buying cars. If you take gas and cars out of it, Retail sales rose only 0.1%, which is nothing terribly outstanding. And U.S. manufacturing had a rough month in August. Industrial output fell by the most in 3 months. Hurricane/Tropical Storm Isaac had something to do with that, put kind of a crimp on the oil industry. All in all, the news today would seem to reinforce, Stacey, the kind of data the Fed board was looking at when it decided more stimulus was the way to go.
Yeah, not a lot of good economic news out there this week, or at least today.
There's always good and bad news, it seems like. They're mixed.
That's true. It's always, and there's always two, there are always two ways to look at it, always. Well, Jeff, I have a kind of off-the-topic question for you, which is, do you buy a lot of things off the internet, or are you still a brick-and-mortar kind of guy?
I shop brick-and-mortar, but I do shop a lot online.
Yeah, well, me too. And most, you know, a lot of people do as well. And it used to be that you didn't have to pay state sales tax when you bought things online at sites like Amazon.
Right. Still Amazon, is that way at lots of places.
Yeah, absolutely. Amazon has started charging sales tax in a growing number of states. And California, a big one, goes on that list this weekend. And Marketplace's Bob Moon has that story for us.
A lot of the big ticket items that have meant the biggest savings from Amazon are the kinds of goods you want to see before you buy. And Morningstar's RJ Hottovy says customers will still be tempted to go for the cheaper price online.
Even if Amazon does charge sales tax across the country, we still think it maintains a meaningful price leadership just because it doesn't have that burden of having physical storefronts.
We compared after-tax prices on a 55-inch TV made by LG. Suppose you headed to a Best Buy showroom here in L.A., then fired up one of those smartphone apps that do price comparisons. Would you be tempted to buy the same model for $90 less from Amazon, tax included? That pricing is in line with the average 10% savings that Wedbush analyst Michael Pachter says Amazon normally beats brick-and-mortar retailers by. But he thinks the added taxes could tip the balance for some consumers.
If the price difference is narrowed, a lot of people are going to say, well, shoot, I'm here, I'm looking at the TV, it looks great, what the heck?
Especially, he says, if it means not stiffing the salesperson who helped you check out the merchandise.
I think that's pretty cheesy.
I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
All summer, we've been talking about this. Farmers have faced a shortage of water in the U.S. Now some are dealing with a shortage of labor to bring in the harvest. We sent Marketplace's Eve Tro to a California mushroom farm to glean some more insights.
Escondido, California is home to citrus and avocado groves and mountain meadow mushrooms.
We grow your white portobello, cremini, shiitake mushrooms.
Gary Crouch grows year-round in long cinder block rooms.
That's what it looks like inside. But
it's dark and humid inside. Music keeps pickers company as they pluck firm white buttons from stacked beds of soil. With a full staff, Crouch gets 20,000 pounds a day. This year, he says he's left 100,000 pounds to rot.
6 months ago, we got visited by ICE.
Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
Most of our employees are gone.
Most of them from Mexico, people who'd been on his payroll 10 years or more. They paid taxes, they had documents, he says, but the immigration visit scared them off. Crouch scrambled to hire locals for the same pay, $10 to $15 an hour.
Some of them say, oh yeah, I can do that, I'm used to hard work. They'll last a day, they'll last 2 days, generally less than a week.
Maybe $20 an hour would induce some people to go to work.
Philip Martin studies farm labor at UC Davis.
But well before we got to $20 an hour, machines would be developed to harvest these commodities, or we would be importing them.
Another way to drum up labor, make the work easier. Charlie Woke with the California Avocado Commission wants growers to lower their trees, no ladders to climb.
And if we get a tree that you can reach the fruit, it's much easier to teach somebody how to do that.
But why bother, say many growers? Just let the people who will do the work come here to do it. They want a guest worker program with Mexico. At Mountain Meadow Mushrooms, Gary Crouch shows me the hardest job. After a room's been picked, workers don headlamps and shovel out tons of dirt.
It's hard, hard work.
As they rinse off, it's clear they're not from Mexico. They're from Burma, refugees hired with the help of social services. Crouch says other growers are watching closely to see if these workers stick around. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
All right, Jeff, I have a very exciting banking prospect for you.
Yay. Let's go.
Well, the Whalebone Cafe Community Bank in Pittsburgh has a very unique sales pitch. It will pay you interest in the form of ice cream.
Uh-huh. listening.
You don't sound as excited as I was when I read about this.
It sounds nifty. I'm not sure I'm going to travel to Pittsburgh to take advantage, but tell me more.
I think we clearly have different feelings about ice cream. Anyway, Ethan Clay started the bank inside of his ice cream shop. That was after he got frustrated by the fees his bank was charging him, particularly overdraft fees. So Clay opened up his bank, which is a very small operation, but he says it's friendly and fair. And this is my favorite part of this bank. For every $100 you deposit, you get a $5.50 voucher every month that you can spend on ice cream at his shop.
Conflict of interest, maybe, nice thought.
You were so much more skeptical of this than I was. I was just like, ice cream, fantastic. Anyway, though, there are some regulators who are skeptical as well. State regulators are currently looking into the business and may shut it down.
And Stacey, quick update on something we talked about yesterday. I know you're interested to hear about this.
I know what this is.
Grey Poupon on Facebook.
Yes.
Right? And why don't you just sum up the basic story there for people who didn't
Okay. hear. Well, Jeff, it's part of an online ad campaign that Grey Poupon's doing on Facebook. It's called Spread Good Taste. And the way that it works is you click on it and it basically screens your Facebook profile and decides if you are classy enough to like Grey Poupon. I took the test. Not only was I not classy enough, I got like a 32%. I got like an F minus of
stunning.
Class.
See, you should have qualified. So I couldn't get it to work for me yesterday. But this morning I had a little time between casts,
and
so I gave it a shot. I want to see if I could qualify. Well, it seemed to be impressed by my number of friends. I have a master's degree, and it like that, because it churns through your profile, right?
Yes,
and
it does.
Points out things, and they go, very interesting. Oh, you're interested in this. That's good. And so when all was said and done, I didn't make it either.
Really?
Which should make you feel better.
Okay, this thing is broken.
47th percentile. It gave me some recommendations, as maybe it did for you. It told me to read Great Expectations, which I admit, I don't know that I've ever read Great Expectations.
Really? I've read Great Expectations.
Oh, see, you should have been in there. Watch Masterpiece Theater is also what it told me to do, which I'm a big Downton Abbey fan. I can't wait for the next season.
So, Masterpiece Theater,
come on now. And listen to Mozart. But I think I figured something out. So my profile, I have not gone in and listed all the books I like, all the movies I like, all the music I listen to. I left that stuff blank because I just think it's kind of lame.
And think about this, Jeff. What is classier than privacy? And modesty.
Right.
If you're constantly hollering about all of the classy things you do, that's just not classy.
Right. And I also just want to point out, Grey Poupon, your little membership app does not work in Google Chrome. I had to switch over to IE to do it. And so I say, Grey Poupon, if you can't work in the slimmest, leanest browser so many of us are using, you are not cool enough for me.
Yeah. 37th percentile, maybe lower.
Of what?
Of
coolness.
Class. Of classiness.
They're in your 37th percentile.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
Today, Japanese government officials announced a bold new energy plan. The policy still needs approval from the cabinet, but just proposing it is a pretty big deal. It would end the use of nuclear power in Japan by 2040.
And that's especially interesting because the country had been on track to get half of its power from nuclear energy. Joining us now to talk more about this is Anthony Froggatt, a nuclear specialist at Chatham House. Good morning, Anthony.
Good morning to you.
So tell us a little bit about this plan. What would the guts of it be?
Well, what we're seeing in Japan is the government announcing a new vision for its energy sector, in which it envisages over the next couple of decades, so by the 2030s, a non-reliance on nuclear power. And this is a clear change in direction from the accident in Fukushima in March of last year. Prior to the accident, about 30% of electricity came from nuclear, and the intention was by 2030 to increase this to around 50%.
Is the motivation for this financial at all, or is this mostly an emotional response to the disaster at Fukushima?
Well, I mean, it's very clear that public opinion has gone quite strongly against nuclear power.
Right.
This has been translated both in terms of this energy policy, the government reflecting that, but also in the fact that up until this summer, the rest of the reactor fleet were closed. Two have now been restarted, but the closure of the reactors, even on a temporary basis, is a reflection of local public opposition.
So, Anthony, if Japan does get rid of nuclear power, how will it continue to power its economy? Obviously, it's a very robust economy.
So currently, nuclear is providing a very small amount of the country's electricity, and therefore this sort of supply gap has been met by increasing use of fossil fuels, primarily liquid natural gas that has to be imported. So the question will be for Japan is how quickly can it build up indigenous energy sources, in particular renewable energy. So there are plans to dramatically increase the use of wind, solar, and geothermal. So how quickly are those introduced, at what price, and therefore not having to be so reliant on imported energy, I think will be an important question going forward.
Anthony Froggatt is a nuclear specialist at the Chatham House. Anthony, thank you.
Thank you very much.
So, Jeff, a year ago Monday, Occupy Wall Street took root right here in New York.
Seems like only yesterday.
It seems like. I know
it does.
It's
been a year.
The movement drew a lot of support, spawned a lot of sister movements all over the country and the world. It also drew a lot of money. And Marketplace's Mark Garrison takes a look now at how much Occupy raised and what's left.
As those crowds grew, something happened that nobody predicted. Occupy got rich. Donations poured in, and the movement suddenly had a distinctly 1% level bank balance. Activist Danielle Cohn joined Occupy's accounting team during the height of Zuccotti Park.
It was really inspiring to have the encouragement of the world.
Occupy says giving spiked whenever strong police responses got attention and exploded after the NYPD cleared the park in November. Over the last year, Occupy Wall Street took in around $800,000 in trackable donations. All that money forced Occupy to confront a huge contradiction.
In an anti-banking, anti-capitalist, anti-money movement, there are always going to be people who have a hard time discussing money.
Individual spending decisions were put to a community vote. Those meetings could be tense and tiring. It's easy to build consensus around paying for basic needs like food and shelter. But scroll through Occupy spreadsheets posted online, and you can imagine spirited arguments on the days when the movement spent $1,400 on tea or $4,200 on T-shirts. Occupy froze spending in January. Danielle Cohn explains why.
People were tired of arguing about money and arguing about budgets.
Plus,
we were spending ourselves into a hole.
The loss of the park camp sent shelter and transit costs soaring. Of the hundreds of thousands that came in, there's now only about $80,000 left.
We're not touching it.
Ravi Ahmad is another member of Occupy Wall Street's accounting group. What remains is earmarked for the movement's considerable bail and legal fees. Occupy Wall Street has largely shifted to targeted fundraising like the Action Resource Fund, now collecting for protests planned around Monday's anniversary.
All our grievances are connected, but we're all working on different things. And so we fundraise separately, and sometimes we co-sponsor stuff.
So the movement that wants to endure beyond Zuccotti Park now thinks it has the fundraising structure to do that. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Stacey, we talked this week, I think, about the yoga pant battle, the
oh,
Astro
yes.
Pant patent battle, right?
I thought about that.
continuing our focus on fashion here on the Marketplace Midday Update, which should be a new segment, don't you think? Our focus
yes.
on fashion. It's Fashion Week in London, and there's one high street retailer that is trying on something new this year. Topshop is the name of the retailer, and it's going to hold its fashion show Sunday on the runway and simultaneously in cyberspace.
Oh. You're
going to have a live web stream. You can post your favorite outfit to Facebook. Then this is the big part. You pick your colors, you just click, and you can purchase.
Is that live while you're watching the show?
Yeah, I'm sure that's
wow.
the way they hope it'll work. That's fast fashion for you. We asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to look into it. So Mitchell, work it.
So it'll be like last year's Topshop catwalk.
You know, grungy, but I wanted to give her a polish as well, but still an urban street kind of feel to it.
Only this year, there'll be a million fans on the web furiously tapping messages about what they like.
It's not a fad.
Retail consultant Stacey Widlitz says social media is now a primary channel for fashion labels to reach 20 to 30-somethings for whom shopping online is second nature.
Not everybody is invited to a fashion show, and you can just get online, you know, look at the clothes, make the models turn, make them back up. So you don't really need to go to the stores.
Retail analyst Marshall Cohen says the target isn't just young women.
The aging consumer, sometimes to the point of dressing well beyond where they should, they try to dress younger.
If you're not a 19-year-old supermodel, it's going to look different on you. So
get ready for some big returns if you do buy right off the runway. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
And before we wrap up here, Stacey, that was a very appropriate, if spontaneous, choice of words by me. A word about that fashion icon for the ages, King Tut.
Oh.
Who was a mummy. So we're going to wrap up. I didn't even see that coming. a London surgeon has a new theory about what killed King Tut at 19 years old. And here it is. Basically,
what?
He was turning into a woman.
He was turning into a woman?
Yeah, more or less. The surgeon says there are a lot of indications from Tut's body shape that he suffered a kind of epilepsy that causes the brain to send the wrong hormonal signals, basically to put out estrogen. And if you're a young man, that's not good. It's kind of a hereditary thing, and many of Tut's relatives, other pharaohs and such, also seem to have died with unusually feminine bodies.
Oh, well, there was a lot of inbreeding often in royal families, so maybe that explains it.
It's a plausible scenario, but it doesn't seem like we'll ever know for sure. There's no way to test a mummy for epilepsy. And on that note,
so he's keeping mum?
Nice.
Sorry, it's a terrible Friday joke, but
on this
Friday
weird
joke
note,
nonetheless.
We'll end the week. I'm Jeff Horwich.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith, and this is the Marketplace Midday Update.
From APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.